Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Anil Ananthaswamy. Author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Anil has written for National Geographic, Discover, and has been a columnist for PBS's Nova. He won the UK Physics Journalism Prize, and his first book was The Edge of Physics, which is kind of a macro versus a micro, was voted Book of the Year by Physics World. And Anil lives in Bangalore, India, and Berkeley, California. The Man Who Wasn't There explores the only topic that is really of any import with regard to us, our very selves. Does a self exist? Are we I's or me's? Do we wake up every morning, as I do, wondering, what is this thing I am in? Anil sheds light on this conundrum by examining the people whose selves are alien to us, people with Alzheimer's, schizophrenics, those who suffer from Cotard syndrome, and the poor individuals suffering from BIID, whose own limbs are an offense to them. Out-of-body experiences, literary connections such as those described in Russian and German literature that mirror the conditions discussed and perhaps shed more light on them, in my opinion, than neurologists or neuroscientists can themselves. The upshot from all of this is I still have no idea what the self is, why we are sentient, and what consciousness and self-awareness are. But I had a very enjoyable time making the attempt with Anil's help. Welcome, Anil, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Well, so simply because his work informs you and his name is mentioned throughout your book and because it's so timely, can you talk a little bit about Oliver Sacks, simply because he is no longer here and you obviously have a great deal of respect for him as your book reflects?
I do. I still remember reading The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and as you can imagine, the title of my book is almost like now feels like an homage to Oliver Sacks. He was someone who made writing about neuropsychological conditions an art form. He took individual experiences of people extremely seriously. For him, understanding people's personal experiences was paramount, and I think for me that really is the way I went about writing this book, because in order to understand who we are, we need to be able to basically explain just about every aspect of who we are, not just the so-called quote-unquote normal, but every possible way of being needs to be explained by any theory or philosophy of the self, and which means taking seriously everybody's internal account of, you know, who they are. And that's the kind of approach that Oliver Sacks really, he really brought that to the fore.
Well, you know, that ties in nicely with your dedication and something that I've thought of for a good portion of my life. And your dedication is much like an epigraph. It's reads, to those of us who want to let go, but wonder who is letting go of what. And it's type of an introduction to your reader, because that's who you're directing your book to. And the question, as you pose, is what is it that we're letting go of? And is that what, as we talked about just before the show, is that what the hard question is regarding human consciousness?
So, consciousness, still remains a very difficult issue for neuroscience and philosophy. So in this particular case, this idea of who is letting go of what, I was actually thinking very specifically about the self, because we keep hearing in popular culture this idea that, oh, just let go and things will be okay, or, you know, especially if you're going through some hard times, there's always this tendency to be told, learn to let go. And when you really think about that statement, you have to wonder, so, the person or the thing doing the letting go is probably the same thing as the thing that is being let go. So I was really trying to get behind the notion of the self and understanding, can we tease apart what does it mean to let go?
I remember following the works of Chogyam Trungpa, who was the father of kind of Buddhist Shambhala, and he wrote, and kind of jokingly, and he was always a funny guy, and he wrote, we just have to let go of this little thingy. And the little thingy is pretend like you jumped out of a plane and you're in your parachute and you have a pair of scissors. It's just a question of cutting the cords that connect you to the parachute, which is the most fearful thing you can do. But by doing that, you're freeing yourself completely. Is that a good metaphor for what we're talking about?
I think it is. It is a good metaphor. At the same time, I think we need to understand what that parachute represents, and I think that was the intent in the book. I like the metaphor very much, but if you don't quite figure out what that is, then again we come back to the same question. So what are we really letting go of? So by understanding what the self, what our sense of self is, what is it made of? What kinds of aspects does the self have, and which of these can be let go, and what is the thing that is doing the letting go? I think in some sense we have to ask, so who is cutting the cords to the parachute, and what does the parachute represent? So the metaphor is great if we can figure out those details.
Well, it's funny, the Dalai Lama meets each year with quantum physicists, and they get together and they find that quantum physics and Buddhism are gradually approaching one another in definition. And it's funny because when I was listening to the mythologies of Joseph Campbell, he talked about all babies are Buddha babies. And you talk about sentience and self-awareness and the self and the other. And I was wondering, do you believe that when a child is born, that there, I believe that when a child is born, the child is the universe, at least as far as the child, the baby, the infant, as it's born, is the universe. There is no other. But I think you contend that there is some awareness of a self at that moment, separate.
Yeah, I think the first thing that we have to be careful about is we will not know what it might be like to be a baby, because there isn't going to be, there is no baby that is coming to us and telling us what it is like to be a baby. So everything that we have to talk about when it comes to babies is a sort of inference from the outside. Saying that, I think it's probably safe to assume that a baby doesn't have kind of a narrative self. The story, so anytime adults talk about who they are, they're more often than not talking about themselves in the form of a narrative or a story. And the story for a baby hasn't formed yet. So in some sense, this complex ego that we are, I doubt babies have that. At the same time, it's pretty clear that babies have a sense of their own body as being their own, and they're able to distinguish self and other with respect to their body and the outside. So there is already some sort of implicit bodily self that's present now. There are experiments that can be done to show that indeed babies are aware of their own bodies as being separate from somebody else's body. And over time, the more complex aspects of our sense of self seem to be built upon that. If you think of what Buddhists are saying about enlightenment or what mystics talk about when they talk about enlightenment, some of it seems to be this whole issue of letting go of our narrative self, the constructed stories that we are, and the conceptual aspects of who we are. In that sense, yeah, probably babies are much closer to that state than we are as adults.
Yes, it seems as if, if you all your life, and not to keep returning to this, but as a Buddhist, all your life you're attempting to achieve enlightenment, and Zen koans make it clear that it's almost, you can't approach it as if you're seeking it. But in in my opinion, it would seem like that state is one of enlightenment. And I was just reading Douglas Hofstadter's new book called Surfaces and Essences, and it essentially posits that all life is based on metaphor because we have no way of really knowing what's what. So when the mother takes the child and brings him to him or her to her breast, it's at that moment that the child, and you talk about when the child's cheek is touched by another rather than itself, it turns towards that stimulus. And at that moment, it appears like the other is created, almost created out of whole cloth. And at that moment, the child begins the narrative of its life.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, within the first 24 hours of its life, a baby seems to have some sense of, you know, whether a touch is coming from itself, like if it touches its own cheek versus if somebody else touches the baby's cheek. The baby is more likely to, you know that somebody else touched it. And you're right. I think it's social interactions, like the one that you just said about the mother bringing the child to her breast. Social interactions, physical interactions are probably the way the larger narrative self starts developing, the social self, the conceptual self, all those more complex aspects of who we are start, you know, getting built upon this very rudimentary, what psychologists call the ecological self, the body being in a space and being able to differentiate itself from the other.
What about the fact that, and hearkening back to Oliver Sacks, suppose you took a sabbatical to Fiji or to Tonga, or we could go to the moon and you went to the moon, and during the 2 weeks that Google News shows Oliver Sacks has died, you miss that. So in your mind, in your narrative self, Oliver Sacks still exists. So that makes your narrative self in flaw, in error. So, or if you're a fundamentalist Christian and your prime mover is faith in this mythological creature that does not have, in my opinion, a divinity to it, your narrative self is flawed, as are all. So then each self is... has a schism in it that makes it not a true reality?
That's a tough one. I mean, it's very clear that, you know, the narrative self that we are is being formed by our experiences. And to the extent that our experiences are reflecting objective reality around us, our narrative self will be, you know, relatively true. It's possible that you know, your experiences are not quite reflective of what's happening around you, and your narrative self can develop these schisms. And the interesting part is that, you know, whatever the development of the narrative self, at each stage, you'll have some amount of narrative, and it seems that the brain's need for or the self's need for coherence is so important and so paramount that the subsequent development of a narrative depends on the narrative that has already been, you know, built up. So if for some reason there's a schism or something that is not quite right with the narrative at some point, the way the narrative develops, the way the things, you know, happen for you, or what you will do in order to build, you know, further narrative, will probably deviate even more because of an earlier schism. So, I mean, these are very, very complex issues to analyze, and we shouldn't make light of it. But at the same time, narratives can be false to some degree. And I think we're all aware that, take the issue of the same thing that is being, you know, the same event, the same episode, is being experienced by a few different people. Each one's sense of what happened can be slightly or sometimes quite different. And in that sense, that same episode that has actually happened has gotten incorporated into different narratives in different ways. And there are movies made on this idea that, you know, the same event has a different impact on different people. So who's to say whose narrative is exactly representative of objective reality and whose is not?
I wonder who is to say.
Sorry, say that again.
I wonder who it actually is to say. Who is that?
Yeah, who is saying it? I agree.
That's like the paradox of, you know, the set of all sets. It seems as if there has to be a prime mover. And as I mentioned earlier, faith can be one of them. Or you can have this intense curiosity that is your prime mover. But at bottom, whether you're trying to determine the age of the universe or where it ends, if it does, there, and you talked about this before too, when we talked about the seat of human consciousness, I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I would think that you would have to admit that I love the book and I love the examples and I loved hearing about other conditions that allowed me to analogize the human self. But at the very bottom, you cannot define it, can you?
No, I mean, and in some sense, that is the point of the book. You know, it allows us to come to a point where we can appreciate that there is still an underlying mystery that is unresolved when it comes to the self. You know, no matter how much philosophers and neuroscientists talk about the idea of the self as an illusion, as a construction, there is still this matter of subjectivity. Something or some entity is the subject of experiences. What is that subjectivity? What is that I that underlies all experience? Is that also an appearance? Is that also something that seems to be so? Or is there something really that is the subject of experiences? And is that the same as consciousness? We don't know.
Switching slightly, but I think it does impact on this, is your own life. How was it that you, and in your TED talk, you talk a little bit about this, how is it that you evolved in terms of what you wanted to do with your life? And you started a certain way, and then, like I said, the edge of physics is a completely different topic than the concept of the self. How did you switch around, and what gave you the motivation to become what you became?
You mentioned curiosity as a prime mover. I think for me that may be one big aspect of my life. You know, there is an intense curiosity, but it also there's also this desire to make sense of life. I used to be a software engineer, and I must admit, you know, writing software never helped me make sense of anything. I used to like writing. And I used to love science, and at some point during my software career, I discovered that I could combine these two other interests of mine, writing and science, as a way to pay attention to my world. So writing really does force me to understand things in ways that I wouldn't understand if I was merely reading about something or if I was listening to other people tell me something. Writing is really, for me, an act of understanding, and then, you know, then communicating that understanding. And science, you know, as we all know, is one way of knowing about our world, and I enjoy this way of understanding, you know, the nature of what we are. So the combination of the two really has been very nice. You know, and in the first book, like you mentioned, The Edge of Physics was about looking out at the cosmos, trying to understand what physicists and cosmologists are doing and trying to make sense of existence. But in my mind, that book, which was looking outwards, and this one about the nature of the self and hence looking inward, they're underpinned by the same thing. It's just this desire to know where we've come from and who we are and where we might be headed. So, in fact, my physics book is bookended by visits to two monasteries. I write those visits as metaphors to suggest that what the monks are doing are not that different from what cosmologists are doing. It's just different ways of knowing, and maybe one day they'll all, you know, point to the same thing. We don't know yet.
It's always been something that I've believed in terms of where we were in the universe, that no matter where we go, because there's an infinite amount of space and of time, that we're always in the middle of things. And I thought in your book, that one experiment where you walked ahead and your colleague walked behind you 3 feet, and in your headset you could see yourself walking, which gave you an extreme disorienting experience. And I always think of the terms of the universe, that if you go farther all the way around the universe, you end up, you know, in the back of your head. You end up touching yourself on the shoulder. And I think that these two books, pardon the pun, they bookend each other, that you have the enormous and you have what's very small but very important. And the two of those, as you posit, may very well meet, at which point perhaps that's when we would discover or understand a certain ultimate question.
I agree with you. I think so. I mean, eventually, physics and neuroscience, especially consciousness, have to come together. They have to make sense in each other's context. And at this point, we don't know, you know, the physics of consciousness. And if indeed everything about the world can be explained using physical laws, and that is a materialist assumption to start with, but
true.
If indeed it can be done, then the two have to meet somewhere, somehow. We don't know if that's indeed going to be the case, but that's the quest.
That is fascinating to me and to you, and as I said, you wake up and you find that you're in this thing, but you don't really ever, every time you wake up, you don't ever really know what it is you are inside of. And it's interesting that you have this certainty, and it seems like a certainty, that eventually there has to be an answer that connects the very large to the very tiny, whether it's quantum effect or whatever. And that seems to be what you're saying, that you actually honestly believe this.
True. Yeah, I mean, but that certainty is also coming out of advances in, you know, in physics and neuroscience. I don't know if one would have had that certainty, 200 years ago. If you were a person waking up without any knowledge of, you know, cultural knowledge of quantum physics or neuroscience, I don't know what that would be like. It would certainly be true that the mystery of existence that we all feel, you know, without knowing quantum physics or neuroscience, we wake up every day feeling like we are someone, something inside a body looking out, being the center of the world in some sense, and we have a perspective. I mean, that is a mystery, and that has nothing to do with how science has progressed. It's probably something that the moment we became aware, of the world and ourselves, but we also became aware of the mystery.
And researching your book, I did look at some of Oliver Sacks and some other books, and I can't remember whether this was in your book or another, where you walk into a party and you look around and you don't see these bags of skin that are covered by clothing, and then two circles above moving back and forth and a hole underneath at the top of it.
Right.
I
write about that in the context of autism.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a point that actually psychologist Alison Gopnik of UC Berkeley makes. It's her way of explaining something called theory of mind, that when you look at another person, you're actually seeing someone that you think has a mind and has desires and intentions and motivations. You don't see just a bag of skin with two holes and clothes. Why is that? And that's because we have this intrinsic ability to look at something, in this case another person, behaving a certain way, and then inferring something about their mind. And that's a pretty profound ability we have.
Yeah, you actually talk, I mean, I know you don't mean it, but you talk about it in terms of us being able to read minds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to if you go to a bar, for example, and you meet somebody and he starts talking, and he's wearing a certain type of clothes, he's wearing golf pants and a polo shirt and white shoes and a white belt, and he begins to talk to you about his golf game and mutual funds and his car, then you develop an image of who he is. But that image could be entirely wrong. Yet
it could be.
Right.
Yeah.
And we do that every day with every person we meet.
We do that. And what it tells you is that, you know, inferring what might be happening in someone else's mind has a lot to do with your prejudices. You know, I'm not putting a value judgment on the word prejudice here. It's just, you know, models you have in your head. In this case, you know, you were talking of someone wearing a golfing attire and talking about mutual funds. There's, depending on your social circle, you may have a model of what that attire means, and you will make inferences about someone else's mind or what might be happening in that person's mind based on your internal model of, you know, of that whole setup. And until something happens to disprove your model, and it can happen, like the person might turn out to be someone completely different from what you imagined, and you may have to revisit your entire internal sense of what that means. Until that happens, you will continue to use your internal models of the world outside.
If you look at your book in terms of, compared to, say, an Oliver Sacks book, yours is much more clinical. And it may be more difficult to read in some senses, but it's more, there's more information contained in it, where his are more, I don't know, there's a musicality or a poetry in it. And I'm not making a value judgment here either. But when you talk about catards, or if you talk about autism or Alzheimer's or schizophrenia, within the context of your book, what are you trying to give us? Because mostly I'm interviewing fiction writers, and I say to them, when you're done your book and you give it to the readers, do you feel like you're giving up your firstborn child? Do you feel like it's the reader's responsibility then to determine what happens at the end or what these characters are really like? When I'm interviewing someone who's written nonfiction, especially science, what is it that you're trying to help us with when you describe these various situations people find themselves in because of the way their brain works or a portion of their brain doesn't work? How are you trying to use that to help us understand the self?
I think, you know, it's basically the way neuroscience has progressed over the decades. We've understood a lot of how the brain works by studying people who have had brain injury and have lost some part of, you know, brain function, and we correlate that loss of function with where the damage is and understand, oh, that's what the front, you know, frontal lobe might be doing, or that's what the parietal lobe might be doing, and things like that. And in some sense, what I want this book to do for us is take this monolithic thing called the sense of self. We all feel like it's one unified thing, but actually it's not. It's a whole bunch of processes that seem to come together to give us that sense of unity. And what conditions like Alzheimer's and schizophrenia and the others in the book tell us is that the self is a very complex process. It literally is a process in the sense that the brain and body together are doing something moment by moment by moment to give us this sense of unity, not just in the present moment, but a unity over time from our earliest memories to some imagined future. And by looking at the way this process comes apart sometimes, as it does in schizophrenia, as it does in Alzheimer's, you know, we can understand something very, very fundamental and basic about how we are put together, while still, you know, acknowledging that some essential mystery remains. Even though some aspects of ourselves might come apart, there is still someone or something. It's hard to use words here without making them all go sort of, you know, wrong. But you know, there's always, like, take the case of Alzheimer's. We know that Alzheimer's destroys your narrative self, but even as this narrative self is being destroyed, there is still someone there experiencing the lack of a narrative or a scrambled narrative. And who or what is that I that is experiencing that? And I think that essential mystery hasn't gone away.
You know, I never really agreed with the Cartesian mind-brain duality. And again, before we began talking on the show, you talked about how the body is so important in creating the self. And why do you believe that? And what clinical evidence do you have that that's in fact true? And I know you give that in the book, but for our listeners.
Oh, it's it's become very, very clear within neuroscience that the body is the basis for everything that we are. For instance, there is, take something like autism. We've traditionally thought of autism in the context of behaviors, which can be, which can be thought of in a cognitive sense. For instance, it's known that people suffering from autism have difficulty with this thing that we just talked about, the theory of mind, being able to infer what's happening in someone else's mind. And at one level, you can say, oh, that's just a cognitive behavioral issue, and what has the body got to do with it? And it turns out actually that maybe, this is still early stages of research, but what's coming out of certain research labs that are looking at autism is that what might be happening in autism is that the person's perception of their own body or being grounded in a bodily self is somehow compromised, and it's that compromised bodily self that then has downstream behavioral consequences, like having an impaired theory of mind. So the role of the body has become very clear. It's integral to everything we are, cognitive or otherwise.
So what about if you approach it this way? What if you look at good and evil as we understand them? Whether you have a Hitler or a serial murderer, when they're born, is there a sense of self, their narrative, what creates the predisposition towards their actions later? Or do you believe, or is there any evidence that it's their brain, not their mind, but their brain that has some, whether it's a lesion or a deficiency, or is it a combination of both nature and nurture that leads them to what they become, the horror that they become?
Right. I mean, if you leave aside really extreme cases, I would say that we are always a combination of nature and nurture. We all have biological dispositions towards doing certain things, and then depending on how we are brought up, depending on our cultural context, our dispositions could be, pushed one way or the other. So I firmly believe that we are a very inextricable mix of nature and nurture. It's very hard to tease that apart. Which basically means that as a society, we have to take responsibility for everything, because we are influencing everyone.
Which is difficult for society to do. And there's one faction of American politics now that feels like that has nothing to do with our lives, that those people are those people, and we need to just eliminate them from our portion of the world. So it's very difficult to imagine a world in which we actually took responsibility for the actions of others.
I mean, it is difficult because we don't want to take responsibility, but at the same time, I don't see how we are not responsible. I mean, it's an entirely different and long conversation, but I firmly believe that everything we do has an influence on everything and everyone else. So, we do come with certain biological dispositions. There's no denying that. But how that disposition, plays out in any individual's life has a lot to do with parenting, has a lot to do with schooling, has a lot to do with the political environment, human rights, racism, all sorts of things. Who knows?
Well, if you go back to, as I said, there's so many really good examples that are discrete within the book. For example, and to me the most shocking one, is the body identity essentially disorder, in which a person's leg or another appendage is foreign to him or her, and something that is desired by the person who has this condition to be gone. And it was shocking to me that I didn't know that such a condition exists. I didn't know that there was a, quote, cure, unquote, for it. And also, I didn't know at the time that you really did, in this book, get, for want of a better phrase, get up close and personal with with some of the people that were actually suffering through these situations.
Right. Yeah, no, it is a condition that is really hard to get one's head around, because, as you point out, the body integrity identity disorder is a condition in which someone feels like some part of their own body doesn't feel like their own, and that is how they will talk about it. Some people take extreme measures to deal with it. Eventually, they might suffer with the condition for decades and then suddenly decide that they've had it and they want to get rid of the offending body part.
Well, it's interesting that, there's a moral question there that you discuss kind of peripherally, but there is a moral question there as to whether or not the actions, which in the United States would be illegal, and you talk about the difficulty in accomplishing the task and the kind of cloak and dagger kind of actions that have to be taken in order to accomplish it. Do you feel inherently that the cure, because it is a cure, because you say all of the people, without exception, feel a great relief that lives on in them for the remainder of their time on the planet, that they are better people because they feel as if they've been released from this horrible prison. Do you have a moral question regarding that?
Well, first of all of the people who neuroscientists and neuropsychologists have talked to, that's already a slightly self-selective group of people. We don't know if there were others who had regrets and they never came and acknowledged it. We don't know that, so we have to be, again, a little bit careful about saying that everyone who, takes such an extreme measure is happy with it. I think the thing here that is really important to understand and address is the fact that the people are suffering, and until that suffering is acknowledged as something that is real for them, we will not have a way of figuring out what the cure might be. It would be wonderful to figure out a cure that does not involve actually losing the body part. But for that, the medical establishment and psychiatrists and psychologists and neuropsychologists have to basically acknowledge the reality of the subjective experience of these people, and then start analyzing as to, whether this is really neurological, that or is it something psychological? Can talk therapy help? We don't know the answers to these things because, it's not even recognized fully as a condition that needs treatment. So, something like what was done for phantom limbs, for instance, the converse of this problem is when somebody has lost a limb because of an amputation and continues to feel the presence of the limb and sometimes even feels pain in that limb. And, 30, 40 years ago, you could have argued that, that's just, psychological. Of course, it's psychological in the sense that it's always a subjective experience, but at the same time, it is real for the person experiencing phantom pain. And once people acknowledged that this was real, they came up with, simple, sometimes deceptively simple therapies. But it requires that act of faith from others saying that, okay, the people who are claiming to be suffering really are suffering, and then let's figure out what the next step is.
Which leads into the, I guess, less controversial but perhaps more unusual situation in which people find themselves so depersonalized that they actually believe they're dead or that they don't exist. Mm-hmm. And you discuss that in great detail. But then you also, as an aside, mentioned the fact, if they're so sure that they don't exist, how is it that they have this selfhood that allows them to be so sure that they aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing controversial in some sense about Cotard syndrome. It is recognized, medically as a disorder, people, like you say, one of the startling symptoms of Cotard syndrome is this perception or this feeling that the person has that he or she doesn't exist, that they're already dead. There is some, you know, evidence now about what might be happening in the brain of people who are suffering from Cotard's. One of the things to acknowledge here is that people with Cotard's can be extremely depressed, more than most people would ever understand in terms of what depression could be in this case. So, and there are, areas of the brain that show very low metabolic activity, low activity, and there's some sort of growing understanding of what might be happening with Cotard's and why that leads to this perception of being dead or not existing. And in some sense, there's nothing controversial about it. It's just an extremely strange condition and an extreme disorder in some sense.
And then when you talk about out-of-body experiences, you directly relate that to a portion of the brain that essentially creates this illusion. I keep using the word illusion. I don't know if I'm using the right word. That you are, especially like in the operating room context, when an electrode is placed against a certain portion of the brain and the woman finds herself on the ceiling, everyone seems to find themselves on the ceiling, looking down upon themselves.
Right.
But, and you can explain that a little bit better than I can, but do you harbor in some way a belief, because a lot of people do, and the ones going into the white light that then come back, the near-death experiences, do you harbor some tenuous belief that they might actually be experiencing something that they describe as true, that I was out of my body, that I did die and then come back?
No, I mean, my sense is that this is some process in the brain that is not quite working as it should be. In some sense, the best way to ask about what an out-of-body experience is by asking what an in-body. Why do we feel we are in a body to begin with, right?
Yeah.
And in some sense, what out-of-body experiences are telling us is that there are brain processes that are working all the time, instant by instant, to keep us in body, in some sense, to make us feel like we inhabit a volume of space that is defined by the body, to have a sense of ownership of the physical body, to have a perspective that feels like we are inside our heads looking out, and everything that we look out at, there's a certain mindness of experience that all these experiences are happening to me, and it looks like the brain has to, you know, do a whole lot of processing in order for that in-body feeling to be there every moment of our waking life. And when something about that information processing or integration of sensations both from outside and inside the body, when something goes a little bit wrong, you can get these anomalies and you can end up, you know, outside, so to speak. But my personal take at this point is that nothing is actually leaving the body. It's just the way the brain is integrating information that gives us the sense that we are not located in the physical body, but in some other region of space.
I remember I had a small moment of epiphany. I was getting a massage, and I said, I was laying down, and I said to the masseuse, Scott, I said, "Hey, look how far away my foot is from my body." Mm-hmm. And Scott said, "Hey, your foot is part of your body." And that moment I realized, wait a minute, what did I just think? What was that? What was that part of me that said, hey, and you talk about experiences like that. It's just essentially.
So there are two things there in just what you said. One is that there was an observing self as subject that was a subject of that experience of the foot being too far away, right?
Yeah.
But there was also this feeling of the foot being far away, which is telling you something else, that the sensation of being a body, of having a body that feels real, is very malleable. That you can end up in situations where your body part seems too far away. And given that you can experience that, it's not a stretch to imagine that you can also have a body part that doesn't feel like your own. Hence, you get to body integrity identity disorder. So, all of these things are telling us a lot about how things might be, what might be happening in the brain and body together to give us a unified sense of being a self that exists. But things can go wrong, and when things go wrong, they tell us more about who we are than when everything is working just fine.
I guess that's where I have the biggest problem is part of me wants to stay outside of what you describe as conditions. And for example, it would be this. There's a part of me that would like to believe, let's take Christianity. There's a part of me that would like to believe that I had a personal Savior who died for my sins and is always there if I have faith. And if I have faith, then upon my death, I'll go to a place that's better. And that would be a place that would be your eternal home. And perhaps you'd see all your old friends and your relatives and things like that. And it would be very nice to have that faith because there is your prime mover. And if you have a personal Savior, as perhaps a third or half of the world believe, then that makes your life so much easier because your selfhood is established and the consequences of your life are laid down in a certain order. And I can't grasp what it is that creates that belief. I have friends who are incredibly intelligent, and I'll say, Harry, how can you be so smart and believe that the world was created 4,000 years ago and that God planted the fossils as a test of our faith? And he'll turn to me and say, Sam, how can you be so intelligent and believe otherwise? And then that's the end of our argument. There's nowhere else you can go.
Yeah, and I have tried for that reason to stay away from from theology. The only kind of theology that I think I gravitate towards is something that comes out of Buddhism and certain aspects, certain parts of the philosophy of Hinduism. But things that should not be an article of faith, but rather something that I can try and verify by, experimenting on myself. Otherwise, we'll always run into that problem because, faith by its very nature is not something that's amenable to any kind. Two people can have two different faiths and be perfectly, they can legitimately argue their point of view from, their perspective, and who's to say who's right. I've deliberately kept away from that.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons why you would. One is because each party has the right to believe what they have to do, and also you want to sell books, and you don't want to offend people, and that may be a little kind of mean to you. But I mean,
it's not that at all. It has nothing to do with selling books. It's basically that first of all, it's a book on science, and I firmly am entrenched in thinking about the world in the context of science. So, a lot of religions run at cross purposes. So, to science, and so I don't go there because of that. I mean, I am very clear that what I'm writing, is a book about what science has to tell me about who I am. And if there are philosophies and theologies that help in that quest and don't run foul of sort of empirical evidence, then I will go towards that, but not otherwise, no. So nothing to do with selling or not selling. It just, some of these things just don't make sense to me.
Except for the fact that with regard to Buddhism, what I consider the nicest, most embracing aspect of Buddhism is that you are, as you said, entitled to your own religion. You're entitled to your own belief. And it's not a question of that. It's a question of, and it's why that Buddhism approaches science in so many different ways, is because it allows you to be open to everything. And I think it's so hard for me to summarize how I feel about your book, although I loved your book, but it's so hard for me to, I don't know, integrate your book with my mindset, my worldview, that, and we can end with this, and I know I talk too much, I don't let you talk enough, I understand that, but if we end with the idea, you know, that there is a brain-mind duality coupled with the fact that the body is so important in that, what is your, if there is, what is your conclusion, which is kind of there, but what is your actual conclusion as we conclude the interview? Tell me what your conclusion is in your own mind and as you wrote the book to the question you posit at the very, very beginning and is posited in your title, which is The Man Who Wasn't There.
Right. I mean, first of all, I think I definitely, my sense now, reading all the neuroscience that I have and after writing this book, is that that kind of duality is really not, you know, not there. The brain, mind, body, all of these things are somehow very, very integrated. There's not something separate hanging out there outside, interacting with the body. So that's the first thing. In terms of the conclusion, I really feel like a lot of what we are, that we take to be solid and immutable, is not so. That even our sense of our own body, the conceptual aspects of, you know, what we are, the stories that we are, all of these things are something that the brain is constructing, and these things can be, you know, changed in very short order or sometimes with great difficulty. But nonetheless, what the neuroscience is showing us is that these things are constructed entities. And in terms of letting go, those are the things to watch out for. And, you know, if, for instance, if you have a concept about yourself that, I want to be, I will be happy only if I have achieved this and this and this, or if I have this and this much money, whatever it is that you've built up in your head about who you want to be, that is a constructed story. And, you know, in my mind, if your happiness is contingent upon achieving that conceptual self, then, well, there you have an answer. Let go of that construction, because it is a construction. And figure out how to let go. It also, at the same time, tells us that there is still something that is capable of looking at all of these constructed entities and being the experiences, being the thing that experiences these constructions, the narratives, the bodily self. And that mystery to me hasn't gone away. I really feel like, no matter how much philosophers and neuroscientists argue, that essential mystery of where does subjectivity come from, where does the feeling that I am the subject of an experience come from, that has not been answered.
And I think for all those out there who I would highly recommend this book to, and in my bookstore it'll be on the front table, is the fact that the title, The Man Who Wasn't There, is completed by the dedication, which is almost an epigraph that Anil wrote himself, which is that in order to let go, you have to decide what it is and who it is that is letting go of. And I think those two statements are kind of create the interest that you will have in reading this book. And thank you so much, Anil, for joining us today and bearing with me as I ask these questions.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
That was Anil Ananthaswamy. There, I get his name right afterwards. Author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Basically, what I think about, as I said, every day, the idea of what is this, who am I, and how can I make sense of a world in which I don't know if the color green I see is the color green you see, and a world in which those who have faith in something wholeheartedly, I feel jealous of because I don't have that. But I do have the curiosity that
scientists. I was going to compare myself to Einstein. I have the curiosity to know that I know so little that I don't even know how little I know. And the idea of life then, for me, is to gain as much information as I can during the very short period of time, given the scale of the universe, the scale of the time we're here, is to acquire as much information as possible. You're not going to get anywhere, really. You're going to only move the Sisyphean stone an inch or a half an inch or a millimeter or a nanometer of an inch. But the idea is to move in one direction, in a Star Warsian sense, to move towards the good force and to let the force be with you. The idea being that you can't achieve or determine the answers, but you can move in the direction of that. And I think, you know, if you think, okay, the universe, if it could move in that direction, it may take a long time, but we have forever in terms of space and time, one contingent on the other. So if you have forever and you're moving in the right direction, it won't be you or your great, great, to the nth degree grandchildren, but somewhere before the heat death of the universe or the big crunch, there may very well be an answer, which is why Buddhism and quantum physics and this science of the self keep coming together. There may be an answer as to what this all is, where it came from, where it's going, or whether it just always is. Okay, that's enough of that. So as I always say, join us every week on The Avid Reader. I'm glad I get to do these nonfiction books because it really is a break for me to read about stuff that's real, I mean really real. And one coming up is Annie Jacobson, who's going to discuss a book called The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, which is America's top secret military research agency. And we got a bunch of other ones coming up that are really good too. But it's nice to have these back-to-back nonfiction ones that give you information, although you may not agree with it at all times, that give you information that you can use in fashioning your own, continually evolving self. So thank you very much. I really much, very much enjoyed talking to Anil today. And join us again next week on The Avid Reader. As you know, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. And every once in a while, I'll tell you, you can find us on YouTube, on Twitter, on our Facebook page, on our website. You can find us on Podomatic. You can find us on iTunes, which is the easiest, simplest way to find us, by typing The Avid Reader. You don't even have to go to podcasts. Well, now maybe with Apple Music, you do have to go to podcasts. And so you can just look up Anil Ananthaswamy, because nobody else has that name, and this podcast will just pop right up. Or you can type The Avid Reader and see every single one of the 265 or so authors I've interviewed. Or you can just type the name of the book, The Man Who Wasn't There, although you might come up with the Coen Brothers movie, which I was going to ask him about, because with Billy Bob Thornton's performance, it was very similar to some of the people that Anil describes in his book. So anyway, that's the ways you can get a hold of us, or you can call me up and I'll be glad to talk to you. Chances of that are slim and none. Okay, I'm out of here.